This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In 2014, Governor Peter Shumlin devoted his entire State of the State address to the problem of opiate abuse and addiction, making public what had been a very private crisis for so many Vermont families, and telling the world that our state had a problem.
In every corner of our state, heroin and opiate drug addiction threatens us. It threatens our safety. It threatens the safety that has always blessed our little state. It's a crisis bubbling just beneath the surface that may be invisible to many, but it's already highly visible to law enforcement, medical personnel, social services, addiction treatment providers, and far too many Vermont families. It requires all of us to take action before the quality of life that we cherish so much is compromised.
But 3 years later, with awareness raised and critical resources appropriated, new Governor Phil Scott used part of his inauguration address to remind us that we are still in crisis, calling it one of the most significant challenges we face. He offered these solutions.
We will break down barriers, allowing models for success and lessons learned to flow freely from agency to agency and community to community. That's why I'll establish a director of drug abuse prevention, an opioid coordination council, and this year we'll convene a state convention on drug abuse prevention. This battle continues to be one of the great challenges of our time. How we react and how we choose to respond to it will be remembered long after our service is ended.
Last month, using records obtained from the Health Department, journalist Mark Davis and some of his colleagues at 7 Days started looking into every death they could find that showed opiates as a causal factor. They found 100, a record number for the state. And then Davis reached out to family members of each of those numbers, offering a chance to tell their story, if they'd like, to put face to the numbers. The Health Department has yet to release its official tally of drug overdose deaths for the year, but it's not likely to be lower than Mark's number. Today on the program, we're going to talk about why the number continues to rise. Mark Davis joins us, as well as Barbara Simaglio, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health. Welcome to you both. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So, Barbara Simaglio, does the Health Department have a number that it can release today for the number of opiate drug overdose deaths in 2016?
We have a preliminary number, and it's just a little higher than what Mark reported. It's now at a 105. And again, that's a preliminary number. All of the required tests are not completed to make that official yet.
But 105 is what you think, and those are specifically related to opiate overdose deaths.
Specifically related to opioids, yes.
And that does not include deaths that have been determined to be suicides?
I think it includes any death that has opioids involved.
Okay.
Yes.
So 105, the preliminary number for the Health Department. They need to do a little bit more finalizing to make sure that that's an official tally. Mark Davis, why did you want to highlight this problem by counting numbers? You know, even before the Health Department came out with their official statistics, you were counting to 100 and then talking to family members. Why?
This has been sort of topic A in the state for about 3 years now. We were really hoping to show sort of the diversity of the population, who actually is being affected by this. The only way to do it is to cast the wide net, find as many as possible, and then reach out to the families. We tried as closely as possible to mirror sort of the Health Department criteria. It's a far more detailed criteria for designated an opiate overdose than one might imagine. So it took some time. We knew ours was probably going to be a little bit off.
And that's partly because in some cases somebody will have multiple drugs in their system, and so it's difficult to say what the cause of death is. I mean, is that part of what you're talking about?
In many cases, people have many drugs in their system when they die. That's a huge factor, yes.
So is there a story that sticks with you of a family that you reached out to?
These were all fairly heart-wrenching in their own way, as you can imagine. One that lingers with me is a 32-year-old guy named John Nickel, who was a computer technician. Years of struggle with addiction, mental health issues, had recently moved back in with his family in Ludlow and agreed to go to rehab to try to get better, but he wanted to wait. He was going to be the best man in his brother's wedding, so he was going to go right after the wedding. Things were looking good, has a lovely dinner with his family. They find him dead the very next day.
We're talking today about opiate overdose deaths. We're also talking about the problem of opiate abuse, and we're going to get a little deeper into what resources have been devoted to this issue, why we're still seeing record number of opiate deaths. And listeners, if you have a question or if you'd like to share your own family's experience, our number is 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Does it surprise you that we've had a record number of deaths in 2016? So much attention to this problem of opiate use, and yet the numbers continue to rise. And advocates say that without the widespread availability of the overdose reversal drug naloxone, the problem would have been even higher. So again, you can share your thoughts with us. Post on vpr.net. Barbara Smaglio, can you talk a little bit about what resources have been devoted specifically to the issue of opiate abuse since 2014?
Yes, we've devoted a number of resources, beginning with prevention. We've mounted several campaigns, one to help parents talk to their children, one to encourage safe disposal called the most dangerous leftovers, so that people don't get their hands on things inadvertently by going into the medicine cabinet and finding them. So public awareness is a big strategy. We've also been working on better identification of people who need help, screening and brief intervention, working with many hospitals, with Agency of Human Services programs, such as in the child welfare system, reach-up programs, to identify people sooner, hopefully before they develop a more serious addiction. We've also added additional medical resources. Our spoke providers, our medical providers in the community, we're due to open a new hub in St. Albans this spring. So we have continued on the both on the early intervention side as well as on the treatment side. And, of course, we emphasize our recovery centers in the communities. We have 12 community recovery centers around the state to help people who want to get help, but maybe they don't know where to turn. So these are open to the public, to walk-in people who just have questions or want to seek community resources.
Other things we've seen in the state just recently, the bill that would require physicians to have a limit on the number of pills that they're able to prescribe for small procedures. We've also seen greater access to naloxone or Narcan, the opiate overdose reversal drug. So some of those also incorporated?
Absolutely. It's prevention, treatment, regulation, and, of course, additional law enforcement effort has been put on this as well. So it's a multi-pronged approach.
Mark Davis, what do you think from your research has been working, and why hasn't it actually been able to get that number down?
I regret to say that I walk away pessimistic after doing this project. The reason is, as Barbara was just explaining, we've been focused on this intensely. The health department, I think, is doing everything in their power. We've expanded treatment. We've revamped it. Law enforcement has been incredibly focused on this, and there is this widespread availability of a seemingly miracle drug that can literally save lives. We've done all of that, and still not only is the problem not getting better, it's getting worse in a really significant way. And I think it's really fair to wonder at this point how many tools are left in the toolbox. I don't understand how you could be optimistic, frankly, as of this moment.
Well, so then what do you think when you sit in your home at night and think about this problem? Then, you know, you say you're pessimistic. Do you think just nothing is going to work?
I wonder, and I need to be a little careful here. We talk a lot of time about a public health model. I think the rhetoric out there is now that, you know, addiction is not a criminal problem. It's a public health problem. I think it might be time to start asking, are we actually tailoring our policies to that? Or is that just sort of a lip service sort of thing? I think a lot of ways our approach still is very traditional. And while the rhetoric may be more progressive, I don't know if we're seeing that on the ground.
Let's go to the calls. Gordon is calling in from Northfield. Hi, Gordon. Go right ahead.
Hey, Jane. Gordon Bach in Vermont. How's everybody?
Good, thank you.
First of all, Mark, as usual, pretty much for you, but and then some, your reportage on this was outstanding. I mean, Pulitzer Prize worthy.
Thank you, Gordon.
Now, Commissioner and Mark, let's talk a little bit about the pushers here. People with MDF to their names, and big pharma, the drug companies, doctors and drug companies. So the commissioner in particular, and Mark too, address, you know, this predisposition for doctors to write scripts like they're handing out Chiclets or Pez when it's, you know, a very dangerous thing called opiates involved. And then if you watch TV, I know Chief Brandon Del Pozo has an issue with this, and I do too. You would think that the biggest problem is opiate-induced constipation. Not the fact that we give out the drugs, doctors give out the drugs like Pez or Chiclets, but that, you know, it creates problems when you go to the bathroom.
Gordon, I take your point, and let's give this first to Deputy Commissioner Simaglio. What do you think? I mean, Gordon's talking here about the root of the original rise here in opiate abuse.
Well, I think going back a few years ago, probably 10 plus, medical professionals were actually criticized for not doing good enough in treating pain. So I think you have to look back to why we started seeing this proliferation of opioids being prescribed. And I think now the pendulum has swung so far in the wrong direction that we're trying to pull it back to say, you know, we have to reevaluate how we look at pain and what is an appropriate treatment for pain. Are there alternatives? You know, the legislature is looking at doing more with alternative treatment like acupuncture, perhaps, so that people don't immediately reach for the prescription. And so I think not only for physicians, but also for us as consumers and patients, we have to ask ourselves, do we always need that extra strength thing when we are injured, or could we use Tylenol or something else that is not as harmful to ourselves? So it's a complicated challenge that we're facing.
I'm looking at the health department statistics over the past 5 years. These are prior to the 2016 statistics. And one of the things that the health department has highlighted is that the number of overdose deaths related to prescription opiates has actually been going down over the past 5 years. And what we've seen a steep rise in are deaths that are associated with heroin or fentanyl or opiates that are not prescription drugs. Do either of you have a sense of whether we're actually seeing physicians helping to lower the number of people who are getting addicted in the first place? Or if what we're seeing in these statistics is people who are getting addicted by prescription drugs and then moving to the cheaper option, which is heroin. Do you know, are we able to look at that breakdown and determine what's happening there?
A couple things. I think we are seeing the curve starting to go down in terms of opioids being prescribed. I think the challenge with more heroin being available is that it's more unpredictable. It's an illicit substance. So we have no way of really knowing how much is out there. But we are seeing things going in a better direction for the prescription opioids.
Mark Davis?
Anecdotally, I can tell you that when you drill into these stories, time and again, the families are saying our loved ones became addicted to prescription drugs after suffering from routine injuries, surgeries. I've been blown away how many times I hear wisdom teeth, as a story told to me. Teenagers get their wisdom teeth extracted. They were prescribed OxyContin. That sent them down this path. So perhaps the overdoses on prescription drugs are coming down, but it is the root cause again and again and again when you reach out to these families.
And do you see that in people who have actually started their addiction problems later? Is that still true for people in 2014, 2015, 2016?
Anecdotally, it absolutely seems to be, yes. And the other wrinkle that surprised me was how many people said that their loved ones were prescribed opiates even though they had a long history of abuse and addiction, had gotten clean, had cycled in and out, and still they're getting prescriptions for these medications.
So, Barbara Simaglio, that suggests that maybe doctors either aren't being educated to the level that they need to be to be on the lookout for that or to be asking the questions, or they're just not doing it.
Well, we've actually increased the regulations around our Vermont prescription monitoring program, which requires physicians to look at the history for particular patients and to be more vigilant about how their prescribing behavior is taking place. So I think from a regulatory point of view and an education point of view, we're doing quite a bit. I mean, are there doctors who are still not paying attention? I suppose there is, and we will continue to try to do everything within our power to educate and take steps to make things better out there.
Our number, listeners, if you have an experience with opiates that you'd like to talk about or a question or your thoughts on what would help, what would make this problem better, our number is 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Let's go to Gwen calling in from Montpelier. Hi, Gwen. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a pediatrician at Primary Pediatrics at CVMC. And I just wanted to make the comment that my adolescents have one story. They have not a lot of alternative. I think some of our regulations to make cars safer make transportation really, really hard for young people to get and inspect and register a car, which I understand we've got to be safe. But it's just hard to get a car going. There are not a lot of jobs. It's definitely, although opiate addiction definitely hits all classes, it definitely hits working class folks a lot harder. There's not a lot of options like sports. There's not a lot of just community things that folks can do if you live in Williamstown, Orange, Barrie. There's not a lot of job options for young people, even if they've finished high school. So I think even though I can get people on Suboxone and get them that first step into recovery, the, okay, what now? What fills that void? What gives me joy and purpose? We're still lacking those things, and it's a much bigger community issue for all of us. And most of us doctors are trying, but the bigger barriers are tough here in Vermont, especially rural Vermont.
So, Gwen, you see teenagers that you work with, that you treat, turning to drugs both for recreation and because of a sense of hopelessness?
I think there's some of that. I mean, I think all of our teenagers have moments of feeling down and depressed and also high and giddy. And if you happen to also have adverse childhood events, you have stress in your life, then quick highs, and that's been true for teens for a long time, quick highs, because you don't have a prefrontal lobe to give you the big picture, the long-term weight. Quick highs are attractive. Unfortunately, opiates are so addictive and so available that it's pretty easy to get started. And I've heard both stories, the heroin and then the prescription stuff. And then once you want to recover, there are not a lot of options. There's not a lot of accessibility, and there's not a lot of those things that just make us feel good and like we want to do the right thing.
Gwen, I appreciate your perspective as a pediatrician. Thank you for sharing that with us. Mark Davis, one of the things that you noticed, here's Gwen telling us that she's seeing this in high schoolers. You noticed in your reporting, this is an issue that affects people of all ages, all income strata. It does not seem to discriminate on the basis of gender, age, or what your income level is.
It was really striking. I think the stereotype is maybe a 20-something, 30-something man, and I think that is your highest category. I was shocked how many people in their 40s and 50s are dying. It's higher than you think. There's more men than women, but there's more women than you would think. There's not a place in the state that hasn't seen these. And there were a lot of white-collar professionals mixed in with the blue-collar people, too. It's everyone.
Well, we're going to talk more about this and take more of your calls and notes to the show. Our number, 1-800-639-2211. You can also post a comment on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking with 7 Days staff writer Mark Davis and Health Department Deputy Commissioner Barbara Simaglio about the number of overdose deaths in Vermont that have been caused by opioid use. Health Department releasing preliminary statistics today that say 105 people died in Vermont last year because of opiate overdoses. If you have an experience you'd like to share, a thought or a question, call 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's go to Monica calling in from South Burlington. Hi, Monica. Go right ahead.
Hello. My background is in advertising and marketing, and it was back in the early 90s when the FCC changed its regulations that allowed pharmaceuticals to start advertising on TV. And that was when the cable market was opening up and long form was available that would make it easy for them to put all their legalese in. So I wish the FCC would go back and relook at that, because I think that it's what introduced the now famous phrase, ask your doctor. I think that's had a big impact.
Monica, thanks for your note. We also got a note from Jeff who says, can the state of Vermont put pressure on drug manufacturers to reduce advertising and maybe to develop drugs that lose potency when they expire? Barbara Simaglio?
Well, as the first caller mentioned, a number of these things are federally regulated. So I'm not an expert on how much Vermont can do, but I think that's something that we certainly have looked at in the past in terms of limits within our power.
Mark Davis, you looked at a lot of people and a lot of records, and then talked with a lot of families as well who have been dealing with opiate use and opiate abuse. What do they tell you about what they think would help? It sounds like many of them are undergoing such grief that it's hard to think about what else would help. But what do they tell you?
Their responses mirrored sort of society at large's responses. They're all over the map. I heard we need more police officers. We need more aggressive targeting of drug dealers. We need more treatment beds. A couple people mentioned perhaps it's time to legalize or have safe injection sites. And frankly, many of them said, I don't know, and which is an understandable given where they are in their lives. Their responses were just all over the map, as you would imagine they would be.
Barbara Spanglia, what about that idea of safe injection sites?
Well, it has come up, and we're trying to look at the research, which is not very much out there. Vancouver is the only place that's really done this with any period of time to see how it works. And so we're trying to evaluate what we do know is working.
We got a note from Les who says, make no mistake, it's getting worse, a lot worse. Besides being a regular volunteer at the North Central Vermont Recovery Center in Morrisville and current president of the board of directors, I am a recovered heroin addict. There is no subject, sadly, with which I'm more familiar. Vermont, like other states, has completely underestimated the enemy. It has no real idea of the size of this opiate gorilla we're facing. Despite all the politicians talking about this epidemic, funding from Vermont has not been increased in 3 years. Under Health Director Harry Chen's guidance, programs like Vermont Recovery Network have been badly mismanaged, with funds diverted from programs to unnecessary mid-level bureaucrats. There's absolutely no statistical models that can indicate if what we are doing now is working or going to work. This monster is killing our great youth day after day after day, and we pretend it will magically go away. How do you respond?
Well, it certainly is a problem that not just Vermont, but I think the whole country is struggling with, and it's complicated. I've been in this work for my whole career. And the earlier caller who talked about hopelessness, you know, we have to look at our culture and we have to look at how we're raising our children, which is a tremendously complicated topic. I think communities really need to look at some of the things that are facing their young people and look at how we're supporting people. You know, one of Governor Scott's priorities is economic development, and economic development is intimately tied to well-being and people who are ready for the workforce. So we've got to really we've all got to see ourselves as part of the solution. And I think that that's where the governor's headed with trying to bring this down to the local level and get everybody more involved and engaged.
Les also said, though, that he's not seen funding increase in 3 years. Can you confirm or deny that?
Well, actually, in the governor's budget this year, there is new money for the hub in St. Albans. And we've seen a pretty substantial increase every year for the last several years. So I think he's talking about something a little more specific. But overall, we definitely have seen increases.
Mark Davis, have you been hearing from people that they're still finding that people who want treatment can't necessarily get it, that we're still having waiting lists, that there's still a barrier to people who want to get help?
Absolutely. And not just from these families, from law enforcement, from lawyers. That really hasn't changed in the 3 years since the governor's famous speech. The frustration level is rising, but you hear it again and again from these families. And, you know, you're going to have to wait a couple weeks. That could be the life or death difference.
Let's go to Rick calling in from Stowe. Hi, Rick. Go right ahead.
Hey, thanks for having me on the show. I'm a psychologist and an addictions counselor, and so, and I've been somewhat critical over the years about the national and the Vermont approach to dealing with the epidemic, and I'm as cynical as Mark seems to be, because I think what we've done is that we've overemphasized a useful tool like maintenance medication or naloxone to save lives, but to rely so heavily on that as a approach, I think, has led us a little bit astray and away from, like what Les was saying, the recovery centers and other treatment centers that could use more funding. Thanks.
Yeah, so Rick would like to see more funding, more resources devoted to those recovery centers and to treatment in addition to maintenance drugs that can help you reduce your cravings, or a drug like naloxone or Narcan that can be used to reverse the effects of an overdose. Barbara Simaglio, is that something the health department would like to see as well?
Well, the recovery centers are an extremely important resource, and so we do support them and want to see them continue to grow and flourish. Treatment is not just about medication. I totally agree with Rick that counseling and support to change skills and learn how to cope with life without using substances, it is not just about a medication. It is definitely about counseling and ongoing support.
This drug, naloxone or Narcan, now is pretty readily available throughout Vermont. Most police departments, EMTs, fire departments, first responders can carry it with them. And people are allowed in the state to get it without a prescription. And so somebody who lives with somebody who's addicted to opiates, or who thinks they may be in contact with somebody who's having an overdose, can have this drug available. How much of a help do you think that has been, Barbara Simaglio?
Well, I have no doubt that if we weren't spreading the Narcan out into all the communities and making it readily available, that I have no doubt we would have more overdoses. Vermont is the
or
only
more overdose deaths.
More overdose deaths, yes, for sure. Vermont is the only New England state that hasn't seen a statistically significant increase in the number of overdoses in our population. So I know it's not a good final answer, but when we look at Massachusetts and Maine and our surrounding states, we're seeing much steeper increases. So I think Narcan has been a lifesaver. It's just the first step. We know that people still need to get treatment on demand and easier access to treatment as a longer-term solution.
Mark Davis, what are you hearing about Narcan?
I think it's worth noting that the health department has gotten thousands of doses of Narcan out, I believe, and I don't have the number on how many have been reversed. But it's chilling. If you take a step back, the health department is saying 105 people died of opiate overdoses last year. I believe the number was 75 the year before. It's a big jump. Thousands of doses of Narcan come out. I think you can scarcely contemplate what that number would be were it not for Narcan. Frankly, some of the people who died in my story had their lives saved previously by Narcan. Others hadn't, but there's certainly a sense that it's widely available, it's everywhere, and still this number is what it is.
We're talking about opiate abuse today and overdose deaths, and if you have a thought or a question, our number is 1-800-639-2211. You can also post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's go to Sherry calling in from South Stratford. Hi, Sherry. What are you thinking about?
Hi. I had a really awful back surgery last May, and I was given OxyContin. I took 30 milligrams to stop the pain, given the scale of the surgery. And I was on it during my recovery time. And, one day I just realized this stuff is in me. I feel it taking me down, and I need to get rid of it now. I boxed it up. I told my husband, look, bury this, do whatever. It's just got to go. And I was just sort of like feeling like I was on the cusp of it, of addiction. And I have no, history of any kind of addiction to anything. And it was a prescription, obviously, that I needed. And I think people that are, just sort of innocently walking in, having a surgery and being given OxyContin need to be talked to about, this drug will take you down. It can help you, but you have to control it before it controls you. This isn't the answer, not by any means, but people just sort of run-of-the-mill, have a surgery, and there they are. I don't think we see it coming. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Sherry, thanks for sharing it. I appreciate you sharing your story. Let's go to Tom in Granville, New York. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Hi. My feeling is the physician is somewhat being unfairly blamed in somewhat in these cases, because what are you to do if you're in pain? A couple of years ago, I had a kidney stone. I was in agony. He gave me a script. I took the script. I was done. I did not want any more. I didn't feel like I wanted to get addicted or get high or anything like that. I just wanted to get back to work. And so I feel, what are they to do in these cases? And is it the length that you're on that is causing this problem? Because do people get addicted after just one script? And my second question is there a drug being developed that will take away the pain but doesn't get you high? Because that would solve a lot of the problems.
Yeah, Tom, thanks for your comments and questions. Barbara Simaglio, do you have any answers for Tom?
Well, I think we'd all like to see some better alternatives. I think, you know, we have over-the-counter medications that work to a certain extent, but in a very serious injury, opioids do work, but they're extremely, extremely potent.
We know if it's something chemical in your body that is going to get you addicted? Because, you know, some people can take an opiate prescription and not feel that feeling that Sherry was talking about, and other people take it and they do feel that. So how much of it is chemical and how much of it is about decision making that then gets you hooked?
I think it's definitely a combination. There are people who, because of their biochemistry, have a higher susceptibility to becoming addicted. So that's definitely there. But also circumstances are a big part of it. I think the other caller talked about patient education. I think that's really critical, because if patients are well aware, you know, of how carefully they have to manage their taking of these medications, that is a really important part of the doctor-patient, you know, knowing how are we going to manage this together. It's not just your responsibility. It's not just me giving this to you, but we're together on this and really have to work on your, you know, getting well and not continuing to use these. So I think it is a change for both the doctor and the patient to have those conversations about managing the use of these powerful opioids.
Natalie is on the line with us from Lindenville. Hi, Natalie. Go right ahead.
Hi. I feel very strongly about this topic. I have 25 years of sobriety. I have to take hydrocodone for a back problem. I listen to your callers and I listen to your guests, and I want to say, at what point, we have the doctors not prescribing, at what point do we say, listen, the user, you are responsible for sobriety, not the doctor. The doctor is not responsible for my sobriety. It's not responsible for me using. I think we need to put some responsibility back on to who's using.
So how do you deal with that in your own mind and your own behavior, Natalie? You mentioned that you're...
I have a checklist system. I put my pain meds in a locked box, and I do go through a checklist. You know, how much pain, what's my pain scale? When do I take it? I make sure that I need it when I take it.
Natalie, I appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us and saying how strongly you feel about this. Mark Davis, what do you hear from family members about this idea of personal responsibility?
As you can imagine, a lot of families who are grieving weren't too eager to go into a conversation about the responsibility their loved ones have. I think a lot of the families felt guilt, yeah, understandably so. Could we have done more? But I can tell you a lot of these families, a lot of these addicts had done a lot. This had been a years-long struggle. They had reorganized their lives. You can't imagine some of these stories. So I think it would be unfair to sit and say that, you know, they bear all the responsibility for this. They were trying.
We got a note from Ingrid in Saxton's River who emailed, could this rescue drug be part of the problem? Is it creating risk taking addicts who feel confident that they will be rescued? Mark Davis, from what I've read, there's no research that suggests that people are more likely to overdose if they have Narcan handy. Is that what you're seeing as well?
I'm not aware of anything like that either, and I can't imagine we'd be in a world where we have a drug that could save lives and we wouldn't distribute it. I understand the concern. It's actually what I'm hearing a lot more from law enforcement recently. I get it, but I don't understand what the alternative would be, just not giving out a drug that can save a life. That doesn't make sense to me.
What's the health department's perspective?
Exactly the same. I think it's called a harm reduction approach, and if somebody isn't alive, you can't get them help. So the first goal is to keep people alive.
What about, though, you've been talking or trying to educate users about this this question of maybe you've used Narcan or Naloxone, maybe you've been clean and sober for a little while, and then people relapse, and that's actually a big risk factor for having an overdose. Why?
Right. I think this goes along with another kind of patient education, which is if you've been in treatment and you've, you know, reduced your intake of opioids, or you've been incarcerated and, you know, your tolerance goes down, you know, which means you can't go back out there and take the same amount as you took before without a risk of overdose. So it's a very serious problem if people have been off the opioids for a while, and they cannot just go back to using the same amount that we used before.
Mark, you found that in some of the stories as well.
Most of these families said that these people were overdosing in what they thought was a good time. This has been a years-long saga. There were good times. There were bad times. This was one of the good times. They had gotten clean, and these families were shocked. Frankly, at first, I was almost going to dismiss it as sort of a wishful thinking kind of thing, but you hear it again and again. It's not. They're being honest.
Let's hear from Lori in Hinesburg. Hi, Lori.
Hi there.
Go right ahead.
I'm a little bit further down the spectrum in having 3.5 years of so-called sobriety, actually taking Suboxone illegally and without a prescription, and would love to get off of it. But it is so, so hard to get off of that as well. And I'd like to see not just counseling help to get off, but I feel like people are getting put on another medication that they're going to be on for a lot of years. And what are the goals to help people to quit taking that?
Lori, thanks for sharing your story with us. And certainly these maintenance drugs, you know, we do hear often that these are lifelong drugs for some people. And here's Lori saying, I want to get off this drug too. Not something we can solve today, but this is a topic we will continue to come back to again and again. I appreciate all of our listeners for sharing your stories. And Mark Davis, staff writer for 7 Days, we have his writing linked on our page, vpr.net. Amazing stories. You can actually hear the stories of families as well. Mark, thanks for your reporting and thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Barbara Simaglio is deputy commissioner at the Vermont Department of Health. Thank you for being here as well today.
Thanks, Jane.
Coming up, we listen in on a Catholic Mass that's held every month in Vietnamese. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. A few weeks ago, the Roman Catholic Diocese of Burlington announced that a decline in the number of parishioners has forced it to merge its two downtown Burlington churches. However, the Vietnamese Catholic community has grown over two generations, with the first Vietnamese having arrived in Chittenden County in the late 70s as refugees. Amidst changing Catholic Church demographics, Vietnamese worshipers remain committed to their own local parishes, and the diocese says it will continue the special Mass held in Vietnamese each month. VPR recently attended a service in Burlington.
My name is Loc Nguyen. I'm a member of the Vietnamese Catholic community in Vermont, which is mostly in Chittenden County. And we belong to many different parishes in the area. Once a month now, we invite a priest from Canada to come and celebrate Mass with us. And the Mass is in Vietnamese, but it's the same Mass, same reading as the English Mass. The first people who settled in Vermont was in 1979, right? So long time ago. So gradually the community has gotten larger and larger. And we had many people in the community who don't know English. So they get lost in Mass. and they couldn't go to confession, right? So for many years, you know, they go to church every week, but they get lost. So around 1997, there was a priest, Father Francis Holland. He passed away a few years ago. But he was the pastor of Holy Families in Essex Junction. And at that parish, we had several Vietnamese families. So he suggested that we form a community so that we can, again, you know, get together once in a while so that we can celebrate Mass in our own language and culture. And then he helped us find a priest, a Vietnamese priest. We appreciate the English Mass, and we are welcome, we accept it, you know, from the day that we set foot in this country. So we are very grateful for that. You know, we're all American now, most of us. So I wouldn't go to, like, Vietnamese Mass every week, right, because there are a lot of good message, good lesson from the English Mass, from the American priests and so on. The Vietnamese Mass is really for us to keep some of our culture and language, because there are many beautiful songs, Christian songs, that Vietnamese writer produced over the years. And we don't want to lose that, right? And we have beautiful prayers in Vietnamese, and we don't want to lose that.
My name is Father Lance Harlow. I'm the rector of the Cathedral of the Immaculate Conception in downtown Burlington, and also St. Joseph Co-Cathedral in downtown. And so we serve the Catholic population in the downtown Burlington area. So historically, when the church was built, there were thousands of parishioners that came to it. Over the course of the last century, most recently in the last few decades, that population has moved out of downtown. So whereas we had thousands of people coming before, now we just have... On Sunday, we've had about 50 people coming here. You know, we speak about refugees and what they contribute to the community. What's striking, I'm finding, with the Vietnamese and the Africans is that their sense of faith is very strong, and they make great sacrifices to go to church. So the Vietnamese will dress very beautifully. The French-speaking Africans will come, they'll dress very ornately, very beautifully. They sing beautifully. They clap during Mass. They're very expressive and very joyful. So their contribution to our American culture is one of joy, one of beauty, one of dignity, something which has passed for us over the course of the years. We become cynical. They bring a new dynamism to Catholic worship and Catholic faith here for us.
The sermon was about appreciation. And so what his main theme today is, number one, is to appreciate for what we have, and then to acknowledge your mistakes, to say sorry, right? And the main part is to give thanks, right? So first is to give thanks to God, right? Because he's the one that created us, and then give thanks to the country, right? To the United States for accepting here, and he stressed the fact that we are not Vietnamese. We are Vietnamese-American. Right? So we are American with Vietnamese heritage. So we have to be thankful of this country. And sometimes, you know, we can lose that, right? And then thank the family, thanks your spouse and your parents and so on. So we kind of go down the hierarchy. Just remind us that, you know, that there are a lot of people who make us successful and make us happy. So it's very nice. Yeah.
Sounds from the monthly Vietnamese Catholic Mass held in Burlington. VPR's Howard Weiss-Tisman produced our story. People across Vermont and around the world have been transfixed by the immigration story that has unfolded in the last 2 weeks, and especially the impact on refugees. In the midst of it, VPR's Nina Keck was reporting on the Syrian refugee crisis from Jordan. Nina is our guest tomorrow to explain the circumstances of Syrian refugees who were waiting and hoping for a chance at resettlement in places like Rutland. That's tomorrow on Vermont Edition. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the program, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.